For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, we've got some sizzling new summer titles for you. Queen of the rom-com, Sophia Money Coutts, pokes fun at millionaires, marquises, and matrimony in her new novel, Did You Miss Me? Anna Kent imagines what happens when friends reuniting go seriously wrong in her new psychological thriller, The House of Whispers. And Amanda Robson introduces Robert Kirkwood to the mother-in-law from hell in her latest novel, The Unwelcome Guest. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Sophia Money Coutts is a writer and journalist who's been widely hailed as the new queen of rom-com. Her latest novel, Did You Miss Me, was published yesterday and is a hilarious, witty and honest look at the infatuation and enduring pull of first love that combines shades of Helen Fielding and Gilly Cooper. And she even reads the audiobook version herself. How could I not invite her onto the show? Sophia Money Coutts, welcome to Read On.
Hello, Red. Thank you very much for having me.
For those who haven't yet picked up Did You Miss Me, could you set the scene for us, please?
I can. It's about my heroine Nell, who is leading a fairly stable, if slightly boring, life in London. Stable, if slightly boring, boyfriend Gus. Stable, not boring, but quite challenging job as a family lawyer. And then one day, someone from her past, her first love, essentially, comes back into her life, sort of accidentally, and it really, the drama and the lulls, hopefully, unfold from there, when she then has to move back up to Northumberland, where she grew up, to look after her father, who's taken a tumble. And there are sort of family dramas, her personal dramas, work-life dramas, working from Northumberland remotely with her mad law office in London. So it's that, really. It's first love coming back into her life, and then various other dramas around that.
It's full of that wonderful sense of nostalgia that we get when we think about the one that got away.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that. Thank you.
And also about when we think back to the simplicity of our childhoods in the place where we grew up.
Well, I'm thrilled with both of those things. That's what I really wanted to capture. That sense of, firstly, first love, which I've read a bit about this now and spoken to psychologists about, can one ever attain that mad level of obsession ever again after first love? And it's all so new and so exciting, and lots of psychologists say no, we can't, but actually that's quite a good thing, because we wouldn't be able to go on with our daily lives if we were all sort of going around like we did when we were teenagers, obsessing about that person. So I really wanted to capture the first love thing, and also what it feels like when you grow up and you move away and life potentially feels quite different, or very different in this case, to how you imagined it when you were younger. And you almost develop like a split personality when you leave home and leave your parents and move somewhere else potentially and develop a new life there. But then you go back and it all feels very cozy on one level because it's everything you know, but also quite alien. And you almost feel guilty about that in a way.
And there is that real sense of, is the grass greener back in Northumberland where she grew up? She's got this seemingly perfect life in London, as you say, where she's a divorce lawyer to the rich and famous, and she and Gus live in a nice flat in Clapham, and they can afford the nice wine and the nice food.
Yeah.
And yet, from the very first page, you just sense that something's missing, that it's all a bit dull, and, well, that actually Gus, for all the fact that he's a nice chap, is rather taking her for granted.
Yes, I think that's very true. He is. And Nell's got to a point in her life where she's sort of got everything. Like you said, she's got this job, she's paid good money, she's got this flat, she's got this boyfriend. And yet, what is missing? And I think that's something that a lot of people can empathize with. It's always, oh, when we get to this point, we'll be happy. When we get to that point, we'll be happy. So I wanted to examine that, really. And yeah, dig into what's, well, again, it comes back to the what if thing. What if you had this seemingly perfect life, but then somebody from the past who meant a lot comes into that and slightly disrupts it?
And without giving any spoilers, her first love did break her heart.
And this has fed into a belief that she doesn't believe in marriage. Well, certainly Gus doesn't believe in marriage. And Nell goes along with that, but she does also have a bit of a guilty secret.
Yes, it's hard to talk about this without giving spoilers away, but exactly. So on one of the early dates, Gus, who's the sensible chap, sort of solid boyfriend in London, reveals that he actually has quite strong feelings about marriage, which I think hopefully makes him more interesting than your sort of average sensible chap. His father left his mother and therefore he's decided he doesn't ever want to get married. He thinks marriage is a bit of a sham. Again, I investigated quite a lot about marriage when I was writing this and read around the area and discovered, you know, really it was the Victorians who started marrying for romantic love, and therefore it's quite a new concept in human history, etc., etc. So because Nell falls in love with Gus years before the novel starts, she sort of agrees that actually, yeah, she's convinced by Gus that marriage potentially isn't for her either. She doesn't want to be like everyone else that she sees traipsing down the aisle in their 30s every weekend, going to another wedding and staying in another B&B. But yes, I wanted to draw on that conflict, which I think, well, certainly my brother and I debate this the whole time. We always joke that everyone in my family is divorced. And I think I'm always intrigued these days by people still holding up marriage as this ideal. You know, as soon as you've got married, it's like you've achieved everything you should do in life. Particularly, I think as a woman, you can be made to feel that like marriage is still the highest thing we could achieve. So yeah, so I wanted to play around with that a bit as well. But yeah, she harbors this guilty secret, which I don't want to tell listeners because I hope it's quite funny when it's revealed in a book.
It is very funny, as is the prenuptial, non-nuptial agreement that Gus and Nell have agreed. And she has therefore thrown herself into her career, and she's teetering on the edge of becoming a partner, which is held out as a carrot to her by her horrible boss, Gideon, who uses it as a stick to beat her with.
He does. Yeah, Gideon was really fun to write. He's, as you said, he's a partner at the law firm. He's a horrible boss. He's incredibly domineering, talks over her the whole time. She's been working for a long time. I don't know if any listeners watched The Split, the BBC drama about divorce law. I loved it. And that sort of partly encouraged me to investigate the brutal world of divorce law. And I interviewed a few divorce lawyers and was told fairly hair-raising stories about clients and separating the rich and the famous, which were super helpful, and prenups, etc. So yeah, so I hope there's an element of sort of comedy and also drama and lifting the lid on the world of family law in there for readers as well.
Nell is forced to take rather a different view of divorce when she goes back up to Northumberland. And people who she knows quite well have suddenly, after a very long marriage, split up.
Yes, it's the beginning of Nell questioning her very comfortable life, I think. Dealing with the divorces of celebrity chefs and rich oligarchs in her office is one thing, but then it's dramatically brought much closer to home. And it makes her question her own personal life as well. And there's a line that sort of runs throughout, which you might have picked up on, that line of you've just got to jump, which I think, again, ties in with her comfortable life. We can all get very settled, I think, in life, not necessarily in the past 18 months, it has to be said. But I think we can all sort of slip into comfortable life. And I hope that I would always challenge myself, and you want a bit more excitement, I think, than that. And I think that's what Nell starts realizing, that she has, like I said before, achieved all these things and is hoping to become the first female partner of the firm of Sphinx. But actually, is there more to life than that? Should she jump? So that applies to, I think, the personal storyline that I'm, again, not going to reveal who it is, but it becomes quite clear fairly early on in the book, and her professional life too.
And as anybody who's read your other three novels will have come to expect, it's a real comedy of English manners. There's another line that runs throughout that Nell says, we never communicate as a family. And it's the unsaid things.
Yes, I was about to say that's true for my own family, but I think we've all got a bit better, actually, in the past few years. Yes, yeah, so that's very English, isn't it? That essentially you make jokes about things. You don't talk about anything serious. I remember when I worked at Tatler, we always used to joke that, you know, your typical Englishman was much closer to his Labrador than he was to actual family members. You know, that's, well, it's obviously a sort of bit of a cliche, but I think it's still true. The stiff upper lip, don't talk about emotions. I think we've all got a bit better at it, but that definitely still applies to a lot of English people I can think of.
And that's thrown into very sharp relief by the prince who is in the book, who thinks that he's charming. He's from Liechtenstein.
Yeah.
And he has those European manners that just cut through that reticence.
Well, yes, he was really fun. I've done this in previous books. I want to have sort of minor royals dotted throughout. So I spent a lot of time like Googling minor European royalties, basically, and trying to work out who I could invent and have a character and have fun with. So yes, Prince Rudolf is a client of Nell's at Sphinx, and I hope he provides some lols. He's a real sort of smoothie, not necessarily a goodie, but he's a sort of, yeah, real smooth European loafer wearing character. So I hope he amuses everyone.
And of course, there is also the British aristocracy in this book as well. Nell's former boyfriend is the son of a baronet.
Mm-hmm.
And you draw on your expert knowledge of the British aristocracy to feed into that part of the story too.
I do. I always, you know, readers who've read my other three books know there's always a lurking posh character, or more actually than that. Because I think this world still exists, as I learned, having spent 5 years at Tatler. There are these mad castles and mad families, and I just love having fun with them. That world is so crazy. You know, the number of places that I went to when I worked at Tatler, and the dukes that I interviewed and the aristocracy that I interviewed, and it's changing a bit, that world, but it, as I said, it still very much exists. So I think, well, I can't let all of that go to waste. We need to have some mad contemporary, in this case, yeah, Lord and Lady Drummond. We need to have them to have fun with them. So yes, it's quite tongue in cheek. I slightly poke fun at them, but I love, yeah, I always want to have them somewhere lurking in the novel.
Now, you yourself come from an aristocratic family, and I believe your father advised you to change your name before you started writing.
Yeah.
Why didn't you?
When he said that, we're talking probably 18 years ago, I imagine, when I was 18, I'm now 36. And when he said that, I hadn't started work in journalism, which is what I did before novel writing. And I was only 18, and I didn't really understand, I don't think at 18, the implications of having what I always joke of as the silliest name in the world. And I didn't really understand that it would get people's backs up, or maybe give people, you know, a slightly misleading impression of me. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people's impression of me from the name is fair, and I have an accent like this, and, you know, I am very privileged in many ways. But I think in the intervening 18 years since Dad advised me to do that, you know, it's like Twitter and social media, and the sort of class thing has become more antagonistic online, and, you know, posh people are in many ways slightly the enemy these days, which is, again, fair enough. Look at how a lot of Oldertonians have been running the government in recent years, not to go deeply into politics. But I do think now, I've said before, I would now, it's not like I'd change my pen name now, because I think that would be silly, and I've worked really hard to try and establish it. But knowing what I know now, I might think harder about it if I was back then. But then equally, there's no point in hiding what you are, in a way. And I think that you can get found out anyway. So I sort of go around in circles on this one. But yeah, I do think that having the name that I have sometimes winds people up, which occasionally makes me sad. But I totally get it. If I didn't know me and I saw my name, I'd think, God, what an idiot. hopefully I can win people round.
Well, I think anybody who reads your books knows that you are quite happy to portray the aristocracy, warts and all, and you haven't swallowed the Kool-Aid.
Well, I think, again, it comes back to what I said a few minutes ago about being very tongue-in-cheek. I think that was something I learned at Tatler. You know, this world still exists, and at Tatler I was writing about this world, but in 2021, you can't write about this very, very privileged aristocratic world and take it deeply seriously. You have to be very tongue-in-cheek, because it is ludicrous in many ways. So I think that sense of humour is something I try to bring to, frankly, to everyday life with me and my name, but also to my work.
Now, one decision of yours, which is indisputably good, is that you chose to narrate all four of your books so far yourself. It's a heck of an undertaking, but you clearly have absolutely loved doing it.
I really love it. I've been to the same studio now 4 years in a row, and they're wonderful. Every year I go in the summer, it's become like a ritual now. I normally have a week written off although I think I gabble, listeners may understand this now. I talk quite quickly anyway. I've always been told, my first school report said, Sophia needs to slow down her speaking, and I've managed to ignore it ever since. So I gabble through it and try and remind myself to slow down. But it's just a really fun, I think this time it was 4 or 3.5 days, really fun few days. And I was very daunted before I did the plus one, my first book. I was terrified. And I thought, God, what do I know about narrating a book? I'm not a professional actor or a voiceover. And then when I went into the studio, I realized actually the writer is in many ways, or in many cases, the perfect person to read their own work, because you can make the words sound like you intended when you put them down originally. And you get the tone and the nuance and the jokes, hopefully, which someone else might not quite fully get. So I really love doing it. I really love being in the studio. It's really hard work. Normally by the end of day one, my throat is pretty achy. The only thing I find a bit trying are the accents. And in Did You Miss Me, my new book, there is an Italian character you all know Red. And I really apologize to any listeners to the audiobook for when they get to the bits with the Italian character, because I'm pretty sure my Italian accent was diabolical. So sorry about that.
Someone wanted to say hi, said Art, grinning at me. Actually, we both did. I tried to swallow and smile at the same time, which I'm afraid made me look like one of the stone gargoyles carved into the stone pillars outside. Nanny Gertrude, I garbled, leaping up to give her a hug. She still smelt the same. Pears soap with a top note of talcum powder. I've missed you. Oh, get on with you, she said bashfully, smiling so hard that her eyes became coin slots. Good to see you too, I said, more stiffly, reaching up to give Art a less effusive hug, hoping he couldn't feel my heart hammering in my chest or smell egg mayonnaise on my breath. How are you? I asked when I stood back, before realising this wasn't the right question to ask someone at their father's funeral.
Sophia Money-Coutts narrating her latest novel, Did You Miss Me?
Now, this book has quite a bit less sex in it than some of your previous books. And I did read somewhere that you found narrating some of the sex scenes a little bit embarrassing.
I think I've got braver at that. I certainly found in The Plus One and What Happens Now, my second book, it was a bit embarrassing. There are quite full-on sex scenes in both. Yeah, there probably is a bit less sex in this one. It's supposed to be sort of more romantic and maybe less raunchy than previous ones. I sort of got used to it. The thing about narrating sex scenes is you've just got to dive in and go for it. You can't be coy about it. You've just got to, you know, get on with it. And actually, there is a sort of semi-fruity sex scene on page one of this book, or at least it's a sex scene. It's not very erotic, which meant that poor Alex, the sound technician who I worked with this year, it was a Monday morning and I had to warn him. Luckily, I'd worked with him before. I said, just to warn you, we're going straight in with a sex scene. So 9:30 on a Monday morning, let's go. And it was quite full on. But yeah, you've just got to sort of jump in and go for it.
Well, you're certainly very good at pointing out the ridiculous positions people can get themselves into in bed. Maybe not physical situations, but the language that people use.
Thrilled. I'm very glad. Well, it's a funny balance, isn't it? I'm trying to write sex scenes that will get readers' pulses racing, but also have some comedy in there, because, you know, sex is quite silly and quite funny a lot of the time. So yes, I imagine you are referring to some of the scenes with Gus maybe in this book, and my usual tongue-in-cheek sense of humour about these things. So yes, hopefully that comes across.
Well, there's certainly a stern warning to anybody who might be thinking of using German pet names for their other halves.
Yes, I don't know how I came up with that idea, but yes, Gus is fond of using very, very, very ridiculous pet names, partly to essentially show off that he read German at Cambridge. And so, yes, my Google history, as ever, it would be deeply embarrassing if anyone else came across it. But I spent a long time researching like the most absurd German pet names you could think of. And it turns out there are quite a lot. So some of them have made it into the book.
Do you have a particular favourite?
There's one where I think he calls her my little eagle schnauzen or something like that. Apologies to any German listeners, which is basically little hedgehog nose. Although when it came to the edit of the book, the line editor had to send me an email at one point going, have you seen the Urban Dictionary definition of eagle schnauzen? And as ever with the Urban Dictionary, there's a slightly racier definition of eagle schnauzen. But I decided we could override that and it could remain as little hedgehog nose for the purposes of the book.
Well, that will have people racing off to their Google searches. And I take it that you are already hard at work on the fifth novel.
Oh, God, that read that makes me feel guilty. I am hard at work. Weirdly, I was actually sitting down this morning trying to thrash out a bit of the plot. I am hard at work, sort of, yeah, getting there. I'm in the really sticky phase when I've probably written, you know, a third, close to a half, if my agent or editor are listening to this, of it. But you can't quite see the wood for the trees. There's a lot basically still to work out. So what I'm doing at the moment is trying to work out the very, very final scene, because I always feel like if you work out the very final scene, then you can work backwards from there. So yes, that is a work in progress.
Well, without putting any additional pressure onto you, I hope you'll come back on to Read On this time next year.
Yes, please.
But in the meantime, Sophia Money-Coutts, thank you so much for coming onto the show to discuss Did You Miss Me?
Thank you very much for having me.
Did You Miss Me joins Sophia Money-Coutts' other novels in the RNIB library, thanks to the generosity of her publisher, HarperCollins. And Sophia will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Amanda Robson will explore the darker side of domestic dynamics with Robert Kirkwood. But first, here's Read On producer Hannah to introduce another summer sizzler.
Hannah Kent is the pseudonym of Annabel Cantaria, a journalist and columnist who has also written a number of psychological thrillers. Her first novel under this name is The House of Whispers, a dark tale of guilt and obsession with hints of gothic horror. Annabel joined me from her home in Dubai to tell me more.
Welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, can you give us a little bit of an introduction to The House of Whispers?
Ah, The House of Whispers is a creepy, chilling read set in the sweltering hot summer heat of London in a heat wave. And it takes place in a three-story Victorian house, the top floor of which is an attic studio where an artist called Abby is trying very hard to paint a series of paintings for a new exhibition, but she's a bit artistically blocked and she's struggling. And that's how the book opens. And then she hears from her old university friend, Grace, who she hasn't heard from for 4 years. And Grace announces that she's going to come back into Abby's life. And we get the sense that it didn't end very well when they last saw each other, and that Abby is very nervous about Grace coming back, and we're not sure why. And the story is about how that friendship unfolds as the book goes forward. And all is not what it seems. That's all I can say without giving spoilers. It is a toxic relationship. I'm not giving anything away when I say that. It goes a lot deeper than that.
As you say, the relationship between Abby and Grace is really quite disturbing. While it must have been quite fun to write about their friendship, dare I ask if you have any friends who inspired this?
My tactful answer to that is I think that most women in particular have probably experienced a toxic friendship somewhere along the way. I mean, thinking back as far as school, yeah, definitely. There were girls in the playground who were really, really a bit like Grace. And yeah, over the years, I have probably had friendships like that. I just think that as you get older, you get better at identifying them and sort of eliminating them from your life a bit faster.
Yes, I think relating it to the playground relationships is very true. You don't realise how manipulative children can be until you see them as adults.
Definitely. There were a couple of queen bees in my primary school and they absolutely held everybody like puppets, you know, and each day you didn't know, were you going to be in the in crowd with them or were you not going to be in the in crowd? And it completely could make or break your day as a kid. I do remember that stuff, almost trauma. A strong word, but you know what I mean, that terrible fear of, are they going to like me today or not?
Now, Abby is married to Rohan, who's not only incredibly down to earth, but he's also very immersed in family life, especially his slightly overbearing but well-intentioned mother, Mina. this is quite in contrast to Abby, who never talks about her family in the present and is described as being autistic. Are you more of an Abby or more of a Rohan?
Oh, I'm certainly not an Abby, but I'm not really a Rohan either. Oh gosh, I hope I'm not Amina. I have a son and I would really hope that I'm not going to be Amina to him when he gets married. Amina means well, bless her heart. She means well. But Rohan is her only son and she just can't quite let him go.
And Millie, his sister, is also a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I liked Millie. I think she's perhaps one of my favourite characters in that book. I like Millie. I think she's very down to earth and she's sort of the hit of normal. When all the other characters have got something strange going on, I think Millie's the most normal one.
So we glimpse a different side to Abby in her paintings. How vividly could you imagine her portraits when you were putting the words down on the page?
Oh, really vividly. And it's been a very strange process for me because I don't paint and I'm not an artist and I can't paint. And I was actually thrown out of art class age 11 because I was so bad at it. And I don't know where the idea came from that I was going to write about an artist and then I was going to describe this series of 10 portraits. But they did. I could see them so beautifully in my mind's eye and imagine them. And I actually wrote a description of each painting and kept that with me for reference while I was writing the story, so that I could keep referring back to which portrait was which. I'm really pleased with the way those descriptions came off in the book. I don't know how they came across to you.
Very, very vividly. You could picture them really clearly. And it's also wonderful to listen to how Rohan views them as well and sees the beauty within the depths of the darkness that she's producing on the canvas.
Yeah, they're very dark paintings, aren't they? I wish I could paint them. You know, if I had any talent at all, I would paint them, and that would be a wonderful thing to do, but I just can't. I really am bad at art. It's funny because my grandmother was an artist, my aunt was an artist, my cousin is an artist. I just obviously didn't get that gene at all.
You talk about Abby having a muse, which is Grace. Do you have a muse of your own?
I don't think so, not a specific muse, but what I do find is I read voraciously and I read contemporary fiction. Like all the things that are in the charts and everybody's talking about, I read those books. And every single book I read gives me some sort of inspiration. So I suppose reading is my muse, if that makes sense.
Why did you decide to write this under the name of Anna Kent rather than Annabel Cantaria?
So I already had 4 books out, 4 psychological thrillers under my real name, Annabel Cantaria. And I was discussing the idea for book 5 with my editor a while back now. And we decided that it was going to be a bit of a step change in tone. Like this book is much more gothic and it's a bit more creepy. And the whole sort of team that surrounds me decided that because it was marking a bit of a step change from what I had written before, it's quite a good thing to launch it under a new name because it, you know, attracts different people into reading it.
I don't know why you do it. You should be focusing on your real work, going to galleries, looking at books. I don't know. Nobody ever got inspired painting dogs. And no gallery ever bought Rufus the series. He laughed. I closed my eyes as I let out an imperceptible sigh. We'd been here before. As Picasso said, I told him, inspiration exists, but it has to find us working. Rohan moved his head in time with the words. He'd heard that before, too.
Rose Robinson narrating The House of Whispers, written by my guest, Anna Kent. For those of our listeners who are not sighted, could you describe the front cover of the book for us?
Okay, so you've got, it's a dark cover, it's very dark. If you imagine the outsides of it, the edges are black, and in the middle you've got a window. The viewpoint is from inside the house. Looking out, you can see a tree, like some bare twigs outside of the window. And standing in the window is a woman with her back to you. So she's looking out of this house into a sort of creepy green light where you can see twigs and a single bird and the top of a rooftop. And it says on the cover, once you let her in, she'll never leave, which is quite a creepy tagline, isn't it?
As you say, it's quite gothic in style. Was there anything in particular that inspired you to go down that route?
I think it was the house, the actual House of Whispers. I was writing about this Victorian house and I I grew up in a Victorian house, but I also wanted to visualise this house. So I did some internet searches. I did property searches until I found the house I wanted to write about. And I used to look at that picture while I was writing. And then the house started becoming a character in itself. It's a very creepy house. Abby describes the walls as breathing or the house having a pulse. And yes, yeah, so the house sort of took on this characterization. And I realized that was quite a gothic theme. And I decided to run with that because it seemed to suit the story very well.
It is a persona all of its own. And there's also a hint almost towards the supernatural in that you know that the house has a history, but it's not until later that you discover what it is.
Yeah, exactly. I hope that the readers keep guessing throughout the book as to what the issue is. I was reading a review today that somebody had written about my book and it said there's a monster in the house, but who is it? And you don't know, I think, who or what it is that you should be scared of.
Yes, there's some very good twists along the road, but I don't want to give any spoilers to anyone. So are you working on something new at the moment? And is it under the guise of Anna or Annabelle?
Well, that's a really big question, actually. I did start writing another Anna Kent book, which is quite dark, and I got about 20,000 words into it. And I'm not sure that dark is what people want at the moment, and I'm not really feeling it. It's quite a hard thing to explain. I like the story. The premise is really good, but I'm just not feeling it. So I've sort of downed tools on that at the moment, and I'm thinking about whether I would write a happier book, a more uplifting book. I think with everything that's been going on in the last year, that's maybe why I'm not feeling the darkness at the moment and maybe just want to write something happier.
I can understand that. You're living in Dubai at the moment. I believe that you were running a workshop at Dubai Prison.
I did do that, yes, yes. I had been invited in by the Emirates Literature Foundation to hold a mornings workshop a long time back now, probably 2019 maybe. And I loved it. I absolutely loved going in there and teaching these inmates. They were so receptive and so keen and so enthusiastic that I ended up having a discussion with the author Claire McIntosh, who was out here for the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. And she was also very interested in the prison and she'd done a tour. And we just got talking and we decided that we wanted to do something more for the inmates. And we put together a week's very intense creative writing workshop for the ladies and the men inside with the idea that they would be able to produce a piece of work that could be bound up as an anthology and published. And we managed to do it. It was a big success all round, I think.
Are you tempted to go back and do that again at some point?
I believe the project ran again this year using different authors. So I hope we've created a framework that can be used, you know, year on year for other people to go back and run the workshops because the inmates got so much out of it. And it was a joy to actually do it as an author as well.
Annabelle Cantaria, thank you so much for joining us on Read On, and I very much hope that you'll return once you've decided whether you're going to stick with a slightly darker story or end up with something a little lighter.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
The House of Whispers by Anna Kent is currently available in print, ebook, and audio commercially. And you can find a full list of her novels under the name of Annabelle Cantaria from the RNIB Library.
Thanks, Hannah.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Sophia Money Coutts to hear the books of her life, here's Robert Kirkwood with a slice of domestic noir.
Around about this time last year, we were joined by Sunday Times best-selling author Amanda Robson. The author of Obsession, Guilt and Envy was on talking about her book My Darling, but at the end of the interview, Red Sail asked her what was coming next.
Can you give us a sneak preview or a title?
At the moment, its working title is Daughter-in-Law, but it's really about an evil mother-in-law. And the daughter-in-law is also not very nice because she's been driven to poison her mother-in-law.
Well, if you're listening to this on the day of broadcast, that book came out yesterday. It's now called The Unwelcome Guest, and Amanda joined me to tell me all about it.
It's a book about the mother-in-law from hell. She's very difficult, and it's really a book about how her daughter-in-law tries to cope with her, and it's a psychological thriller, and it's rather a cat and mouse between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law.
I look across the breakfast table at my husband, Miles, and the reasons I married him move towards me with certainty. We are in tune, both physically and mentally. Why do I ever doubt him? It's not Miles I have a problem with, but you, Caprice. His mother. A frail and lonely widow with kind eyes and a swan-like neck. Or the mother-in-law from hell with a witch's cackle for a laugh. Whichever. You have infiltrated our lives.
Now, you seem to like thrilling us in a very domestic setting.
Yes, all my thrillers are domestic noir. It always fascinates me, the problems that can happen behind closed doors.
You were living in the self-contained annex that abuts our house, built especially for you. But you have decided it no longer suits. It's suddenly become too pokey. So you've moved in with us. And you're here at breakfast time, sitting next to me, cracking the top of your boiled egg with sledgehammer ferocity. As my husband frequently points out, you are still a beautiful woman. I like to reply, for your age. Just to remind us both that I am young and you are old. Youth is more powerful than age, I hope. For our relationship has become a battle.
Now, I have to ask, what was the relationship you had with your mother-in-law?
I found her quite difficult. She was nothing like as bad as the monster that I've created in this book because it's a psychological thriller. A lot of my friends have had trouble with their mothers-in-law, which is partly what inspired me to write this, because I think there's a lot of cases where mother-in-laws maybe don't make their daughters-in-law particularly welcome into the family group. They don't possibly treat them as a full member of the family. They're more like an appendage in brackets. And I think there is a lot of emotional cruelty that goes on, and vice versa. As an older woman now, I quite often meet women who are very kind older women who say they just can't get on with their daughters-in-law, and they paint a different picture the other way around. So I think it's a toxic relationship in a way, because you choose your partner, but you don't choose your partner's mother, and then that relationship is one that you can't step away from. So that's why it fascinated me so much.
And there's a different sort of love between love for your partner and love for your mum.
Yes, I think it does put a lot of men in difficult situation. I get on very well with my daughter-in-law, my son's wife, and we're not in competition with each other at all. We both love my son. He loves both of us in a different way. And we're all very comfortable together. But for a lot of women, there's a sort of competition in a way for the man's attention. So I do sort of wonder whether it's partly the man's fault as well, because he doesn't manage to reassure the mother and the wife of his feelings. I don't know why it's a competition.
One thing that's transitioned from your professional life into your writing is poison. And you hinted last year that it might be involved this time too.
Oh, yes, I'm afraid so. I only worked at the poisons unit for about a year, and I don't think I quite realised what a terrible effect it's going to have on me, because the amount of poisoning in my novels is quite horrendous, actually.
Toxic relationships and claustrophobic relationships are the heart of some of your novels, where there's no real escape. Do you think that lockdown has been a breeding ground for this type of story?
I should imagine it has. Yes, they do say there's been a huge increase in domestic violence, for example. But I, Yes, I wonder what statistics are going to come out of this, with people not being able to get away from one another. And, you know, even a lot of very positive relationships where people are just used to having their own time and space in the office and sort of coming together at the end of the day, there must have been a tremendous intensity for people. And yet an awful lot of people have said how much they've loved it, haven't they?
They've
loved having more time with their families. Or I heard somebody on the radio the other day just saying how much he'd got that they'd all been isolating together and he'd managed to really get to know his grandchildren for the first time. So there's been a lot of positive things as well.
I know some writers, you would think they would get a lot done under lockdown, but a lot of them found it hard to work. What about yourself? Did you find it easier? Quite difficult?
No, I found it harder. We were isolating together as a group. My partner, my son and his wife, and my other son, we were all together. We seemed to spend an awful lot of time sort of trying to order food from the supermarkets or just sort of worrying about the situation or supporting one another. And I found I was getting far less work done than I would in a normal day. I'm not quite sure what I was up to. I've been less productive, definitely.
Now, when it comes to writing, what comes first? Is it plot or is it character?
With me, it's the plot for these psychological thrillers. And I think partly as well is because I spent 7 years trying to write historical fiction and I had just far too complicated a plot. And the more I tried to sort it out, the more it went wrong. So I think from then on, I just decided to have a very clear plot first. But it's not because I'm not interested in character, but it's just the way I've had to do it for this type of novel. I mean, I love books that are character driven. I mean, that's what fascinates me most, really.
Because you do write from the character's point of view. Now, how do you find each voice? And do you read it back to yourself in the voice of that character?
Yes, well, what I try and do is when I'm writing, I try and imagine every scene in my head and act it through. When I was younger, I used to do a bit of amateur dramatics. I love acting. I love films and plays. And I sort of act each scene out in my head, pretending I am that character. So I'm sort of in that character's head while I'm writing it. And that's what I try and do. I'm not sure I read it back enough to try and make sure the voices are individual. It is difficult, I think, for a writer to make sure that the voices are individual enough. Because if you're imagining that character in your head, there's possibly a bit too much of your own imagination, your own thoughts in each character. So it's one of the criticisms when my work or when most writers' work gets edited, I think, is for the editors to try and make sure the characters are individual enough.
Now, talking of individual characters and voices, My Darling has two narrators, Envy has three, Guilt and Obsession both have four, and this new one has five narrators. You're keeping the narrating industry alive here.
I like doing that. You've counted carefully, haven't you? I can't even remember whether it was five in my last one, but anyway, yeah, I find it interesting looking at things through everybody else's head, you know, different heads. I think it always fascinates me. Did you see The Affair?
Yes.
Yeah, but that was interesting because they'd have the scenes through the different characters' eyes, and in one of the first scenes when he met the girl that he ended up having the affair with, they had the scene in her eyes and in his, and they met in that diner, in a diner, and in the way they filmed it, they'd even put some of the positions of where the people were sitting in slightly different places, which I thought was very clever because we do remember things slightly differently, don't we? I mean, I quite often say to my husband, do you remember X or Y? And he remembers it slightly differently.
Do you ever do that? Do you ever have your characters play out the same scene, but it's very different in their own heads?
What I've done occasionally is have it written in a certain way through one character's eyes and later on have it mentioned differently. And every time I've done that, one of my editors picked it up and said, oh, you can't do that. And I've had an argument with them and said, well, yes, you can, because who knows what the memory's like. So that's all I've managed to do.
Now, as I said, this one has five different points of view. Of course, the audiobook is read by five different people. Did you have any input into the narrators?
I think Avon HarperCollins, my publishing house, I think they have I hope it's good because they have a very good standard, my publishing house. And my mum is blind. She can't see. She listens to all my books on audio and she says they're very well done. So I certainly hope so.
Do you never fancy reading one of the characters yourself?
Yeah, I'd love that. I used to do amateur dramatics. So Yeah, I mean, I would love to. But these professional actors and actresses, they're incredible. I mean, when I do hear some of what they've read out of my book, I think it's amazing. Just their intonation and the emotion they put into it. I don't think somebody like myself, who's not a trained actor or actress, could possibly compete with the way they you know, their standard's amazing.
Last year when you were on, you mentioned you were talking to various experts, as My Darling had quite a forensic plot. What research did you do this time?
This was much easier for me. My Darling was really difficult for me to write because of all the forensics in it. And fortunately, a very dear friend of mine had put me in touch with a very senior lady crime scene investigator who loved crime fiction. And she was amazing. Yeah, I had to have so much help with the actual science behind that. But with this, it came to me a lot more easily because I'd always been very interested and empathetic with all my girlfriends who'd had trouble with mothers-in-law. So to make up this really evil mother-in-law, it was just such fun, you know, and it just sort of came to my head. And because I have worked at the poisons unit and I know quite a bit about drugs and poisoning and overdose and all that sort of stuff, I don't think I really, in my acknowledgements, I've not had to thank any scientists this time. It came to me quite naturally from my own knowledge and my own imagination.
And what can we look forward to next?
Well, I've got two projects on the go. I've got one which is another crime fiction called A Week in Amalfi, and it's about a family who go on holiday, and there's all sorts of it's all sort of horrible arguments and a few people falling off cliffs and things. It's not very nice, and I'm finding it a bit tricky at the moment.
Was that a way of traveling while we couldn't? You were traveling in your head?
Well, no, I went on holiday for a friend's 60th birthday there in 2019. And I did quite a lot of people watching, and they kept teasing me and saying, are you going to write a book about us? And it isn't really about them, the people I was on holiday with at all, actually. But it just got seeded in my head to write a book about these people all together in a villa on Amalfi. And the other one I've got, which I really care about, is I've written a book which hasn't actually got a crime in it. And it's about a woman who's in a coma. And she's got two different versions of her life, of what it was or what it could have been, going through in her head with sort of talking to her alter ego. And it's all a bit about what your life is and what your life could be, you know, how easily it could be different. And that's something that I finished. And I'm just sort of wondering what to do with, because it's not actually a crime in it. So it's a slight different genre. And, you know, I'd love to try and get it published and sort of start approaching publishers to see who's interested in it. So that's very dear to my heart. I've been writing that on and off in between psychological thrillers. I've been writing it on and off for about 5 years. So that would be my ambition really in the autumn, is to try and find a publisher for that.
Over the years, I have tried so hard to make you like me, but it was difficult from the start. You made it quite clear I wasn't your sort of person the first time we met, when Miles invited me to your family home for Sunday lunch. A painful affair in your large medieval hall of a dining room, which looked out onto a garden that never ended. It blended into the horizon, dripping with thousands of pounds worth of showcase flowers. Rupert, Miles's father, was still alive then, presiding at the head of the table, carving a succulent joint of beef. Miles sat opposite me. A low-slung crystal chandelier dangled between us. His eyes glistened into mine, trying to encourage me to relax. Aidan, Miles's younger brother, was sitting next to me. The silence in the room was suffocating.
So she had the perfect marriage until her mother-in-law moved in. The Unwelcome Guest by Amanda Robson came out yesterday, if you're listening to this on the day of broadcast, in audio, print, and as an ebook. And Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you, Robert.
Thanks, Robert. And now let's return to Sophia Money-Coutts to hear the books of her life.
So, Sophia, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, there was. And it may surprise some people, but it was really Bill Bryson who made me want to write. I remember being a teenager, really, sort of 13 onwards. And I must have read I think it was probably Notes from a Small Country, his book about touring Britain, and then read all the others. This was real Bill Bryson heyday, like A Walk in the Woods was coming out, Down Under was coming out. They then did a book of his columns that he wrote for the Mail, Notes from a Big Country. And there's something about his tone, the comedy, the very light touch that he has, at the same time as being brilliantly observational about his travels and life, that I just completely became hooked on. And I thought he was so clever and so brilliant. And I think there's a real snobbery about Bill Bryson that always really annoys me. I think lots of literary people look down upon, which is mad because he's sold millions of copies. And as I said, his tone is just so wonderful. I would read him writing about anything in the world. I mean, he's, you know, written about everything in the world pretty much with most of his books. To the extent that I did actually write him a love letter when I was a teenager, and I got a fan letter, and I got one back, which was very sweet. Although I'm always really embarrassed to say that I've lost it and I should have kept it. So really it was Bill Bryson that inspired me. And if I ever have a moment when I want to reach for a comfort book, he would still be one of mine. And his sense of humour just gets me every time.
I hadn't been to Wapping since I'd left there in the summer of 1986, and was eager to see it again. I had arranged to meet an old friend and colleague, so I went now to Chancery Lane and caught an underground train. I do like the underground. There's something surreal about plunging into the bowels of the earth to catch a train. It's a little world of its own down there, with its own strange winds and weather systems, its own eerie noises and oily smells. Even when you've descended so far into the earth that you've lost your bearings utterly and wouldn't be in the least surprised to pass a troop of blackened miners coming off shift, there's always the rumble and tremble of a train passing somewhere on an unknown line even further below. And it all happens in such orderly quiet. All these thousands of people passing on stairs and escalators, stepping on and off crowded trains, sliding off into the darkness with wobbling heads and never speaking, like characters from Night of the Living Dead.
John Chancer narrating Notes from a Small Island by Bill Bryson, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, it might be a bit predictable, but essentially it would be a P.G. Wodehouse, not necessarily a specific one, although I love the Blanding series about Lord Emsworth and his prize pig. But P.G. Wodehouse, when I decided, you know, as I was around 13, 14, that I wanted to be a writer, I wrote to my grandfather, who was also, he was a journalist, really, but a writer, and said, "Grandpa, why want to be a writer? What do I do?" And he sent me a letter back saying, "You need to read every single book ever written by P.G. Wodehouse and Evelyn Waugh." He was quite sort of old school like that. And I'm quite embarrassed that I still haven't read all the Evelyn Waughs, but I think I have read a lot of the P.G. Wodehouses, and I have an enormous stack in my flat. And really, I think on a rainy day, he is still very comforting to pick up almost any book. You can do a Jeeves short story if you, you know, you've only got 20 minutes or so. And again, his ebullient sense of humour shines through, and you can forget about whatever's bothering you in the real world.
The morning sunshine descended like an amber shower bath on Blanding's castle, lighting up with a heartening glow its ivied walls, its rolling parks, its gardens, outhouses and messuages, and such of its inhabitants as chanced at the moment to be taking the air. It fell on green lawns and wide terraces, on noble trees and bright flower beds. It fell on the baggy trouser seat of Angus McAllister, head gardener to the 9th Earl of Emsworth, as he bent with dour Scottish determination to pluck a slug from its reverie beneath the leaf of a lettuce. It fell on the white flannels of the Honourable Freddy Threepwood, Lord Emsworth's second son, hurrying across the water meadows. It also fell on Lord Emsworth himself and on Beach, his faithful butler. They were standing on the turret above the west wing, the former with his eye to a powerful telescope, the latter holding the hat which he had been sent to fetch.
"Beach," said Lord Emsworth.
"My lord?"
"I've been swindled. This dashed thing doesn't work."
"Your lordship cannot see clearly?"
"I can't see at all, dash it. It's all black."
The butler was an observant man. Perhaps if I were to remove the cap at the extremity of the instrument, my lord, more satisfactory results might be obtained.
A wide selection of books by P.G. Wodehouse is available from the RNIB Library, including a complete collection of Blanding's short stories, Lord Emsworth Acts for the Best, which is narrated by Bruce Montagu.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
The book I've read most recently, which I completely fell for and think everybody should read, especially single women, is Natasha Lunn's Conversations on Love. It's nonfiction. It's sort of a memoir. Natasha has been writing a newsletter for 4 years. She works for Red Magazine. She's a journalist and now a very successful author. So as I said, she wrote this newsletter about love. She's always been fascinated in love and how it drives us, all the weird and wonderful facets of love. And this book is the result. So it charts her life and loves and relationships. And it's interspersed with interviews with the people that she talked to for her newsletter. And as a single woman who would, you know, like to fall in love again at some point, it's very comforting. There's a lot in there to take comfort from. But then she goes through married love as well, and then talks about the fact that as a culture, we can obsess about romantic love, which means that we miss out on other forms of love around us, you know, the love of friends or parents or children, whatever. So I would really recommend read Conversation on Love by Natasha Lunn. It's just brilliant.
For years, I was committed to longing. Longing for a reply to a text message, for an I love you, or for a man to look at me a certain way. If I was in a relationship, I longed for it to last. And if I wasn't, I longed to find one. My longing was a restlessness that spread out into my life like a mist. I could not see anything clearly with it there. I used to think it was love that I was longing for, but I was wrong. I was obsessed with the idea of love, not the truth of it. All those years and nights I spent asking, when will I find love? I never paused to think about what precisely it was. Do many of us? We don't learn about love at school. We don't research it or take a test in it or review it once a year. We're encouraged to learn about economics and grammar and geography, but not to know about love. It seems strange to me how we expect so much from love and yet devote so little time to understanding it, like wanting to dive into the sea but having no interest in learning how to swim.
Conversations on Love by Natasha Lunn is narrated by a cast of well-known readers, including the author herself, Greg Wise, Lem Sisse, and Susie Orbach. And it's available commercially.
Sophia Money-Coutts, thank you so much for sharing your obvious joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Oh, well, thank you for listening and thank you for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can listen to us anytime by subscribing to your favourite podcast provider. Simply search for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to all my guests, to producer Hannah, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.